My name is Phil Lightstone. I'm a general aviation pilot with over 2,100 hours in my logbook, flying almost every week with over 30 years' experience in the technology and aviation industries. Just like to welcome into the Plane Talk cockpit, Mark Van Berkel. Mark's a very interesting man, and he is now the new CEO and president of the Canadian Owners and Pilots Association, COPA, starting in the job in May of this year. Welcome, Mark.
Well, thanks, Phil. Thank you for inviting me to have that. Yeah, I'm pretty new to the job. Yeah, I've been literally a month and maybe a week at this point. So I'm pretty new to the job, but certainly not new to aviation, certainly not new to general aviation in Canada.
I see you've got your PPL with the Group 3 IFR rating. And interestingly, you're an aircraft maintenance engineer on the avionics side.
Yeah, I've worked my whole, in fact, you know, when I graduated from high school many years ago, I wanted to become a pilot. But there was no real way for me to do it. You know, it was expensive. I came from, you know, a family that was able to, their contribution to putting me through school was letting me live at home. So there was no, you know, there was no bank of mom and dad for me to draw on. And there wasn't really the scholarships and financing opportunities that are available now for people going into aviation that there were so back then. So really, I found myself in university and I went for a year in university and still didn't really know what I wanted to do and ended up picking up a catalog from SAIT, basically with all their, I guess it's called calendar, I guess with all their courses. And what resonated with me was avionics. I had done electronics in high school for 3 years. I'd won the award in high school for electronics and I loved airplanes. And so avionics became this natural thing I gravitated to. In fact, it was crazy. I didn't even think of it at the time. It didn't even occur to me that airplanes had electronics. Of course, now they have a lot of electronics in them. And so that's how I began my career in aviation and really took my first job out of school. I went to Pitt Meadows, British Columbia, worked for this small avionics shop, turned down jobs at Canadian Airlines. I turned down jobs out on the East Coast and took it because I could learn to fly. And that was really my passion, you know, showing itself coming out where you're making decisions with your heart and not always with your head. But I wanted to fly.
Wow. And I see that, you know, 8 years at Transport Canada as a chief avionics specialist, 4 years at Aero Product Sales, a year and a half at Satcom Direct Avionics, but pretty interesting, 12 years president and CEO of True North Avionics, and back in 2012, the Ottawa Business Journal gave your company, under your leadership, an award for one of the fastest growing companies.
Yeah, so I did do some stints there. So when I left British Columbia, I moved to Ottawa and I did work for Transport Canada on the operational side. I was never a regulatory person. I was on the operational side and I was looking after the aircraft, all the avionics modifications that were being done on those aircraft. I was looking after them and it was a great job. And I found myself putting the satellite telephone systems on the Prime Minister's corporate jet. And it was the first, nobody had done this. This is back in the late 90s, or, you know, mid to late 90s. And nobody really knew anything about it. So I learned about it. It was part of my forte and I was learning about it. It was something that was really cool. I mean, this is when most people didn't even have an internet at home yet, right? You know, there was that sort of thing where, you know, putting a telephone on a jet was a big deal.
Or a cell phone.
Yeah, it's like a cell phone, but it was using a satellite system that actually was Canadian developed. Intelsat had a satellite system. Anyway, there was a local Canadian company that was doing this. We were using their satellite antenna and their radome. And I actually did a lot of the, you know, help with the certification work for that radome and for that antenna installation on the tail of a Challenger jet, for which I think some of the data is still being used today by various service centers and even Bombardier. And So it happened to be that, you know, this is when Nortel has got their big tech boom and they're hiring away technical people and engineers, you know, all over the place. Well, I found myself being offered a job by this local company to come work. And I really didn't want to, really wasn't looking to move, but it made sense to me at the time, a couple of young kids and that, and it was an opportunity. So I left Transport Canada and went there. And from there, I learned a lot about the satellite communication business, to the point where, after working there about 4 or 5 years, I started my own company. And that's really the True North Avionics story, was me starting something, me going off on my own, seeing a business opportunity, because they were doing telephones and they had started on the doing an internet system for the jets, but nobody was doing voice over IP and nobody was doing all these things that are absolutely very common today. You know, this whole converged communication stuff that's going on, telephones and internet and Wi-Fi and all this. And that's what True North was all about. And so I started that
Amazing.
in 2006, ended up selling the company in 2016, so 10 years later, to the company, to Satcom Direct out of Melbourne, Florida. And now I find myself as the present CEO at Copa.
Well, welcome aboard. It certainly sounds like you have this interesting blend of experience that can really help grow Copa in an environment of declining pilots here in Canada, pilot shortage, the declining airplanes, and airports under threat of closure.
Yeah, you know what? Absolutely, all of those things. The one thing that I would like to bring, we talk a lot about, you know, we talk about a lot of the negativity in aviation that's going on today. We talk about regulatory challenges, we talk about airspace challenges, we talk about airports closing and that. And I'd like to go back and remember the romance. I mean, the thing that brought me into aviation, you know, was the idea that I was, you know, my dad and I would go down to the airport with a bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken and watch airplanes. And that's really where I grew. And like I said, I made some decisions in my early life because of the love of airplanes. And we forget about the love of flying. All of us fly, those who fly, we love it. It's freedom. It, you know, there's never been, I mean, there's been flights where they've been challenging and they've been a lot of work and you're glad that they're over. But there's so many other times where it's just been like, I can't believe I get to do this. I can't believe how wonderful this is. I mean, I've landed, I've had some great flights where I feel like I'm still flying, you know, 3 hours after the flight, I'm still flying. Like, it just such a beautiful, wonderful feeling. I mean, the approach into Billy Bishop Airport in Toronto, if anybody has not done that, it's a definitely aviation bucket list to do, because you feel like an eagle as you fly over Lake Ontario and you make the approach in towards the city. It's just, you can't describe how you feel about it. So back to your question, yeah, there's airport closures and there's challenges to aviation, but we have to, I think, for us to bring new people in to aviation, and this is all of our jobs as pilots, because we should be introducing the love of aviation to those who are would be interested in knowing about it. Is remember the good things. You know, the airport closures and that, we have to fight them, and we have, and that's what COPA is doing, you know, with advocacy role. But we have to remember the love of aviation that we have, and that's really why how we bring new people into aviation, quite frankly.
And that fundamentally is the grassroots of dealing with the pilot shortage in North America, whether it's the Copa for Kids program that I've participated in personally, or EAA's Young Eagles. You know, our Copa flight at the Buttonville Municipal Airport, we would see 200, 250 kids being flown in, you know, on a Saturday. And of course, the airport abuzz with parents, activity, pilots, ground crew. I mean, absolutely amazing to see the, you know, the wide-eyed kids, you know, the 7-year-old getting out of the airplane and, you know, running to mom or dad and
For sure. Yeah. And the COPA for kids, I think it's been rebranded as Discover Aviation, but same concept is to try and introduce, you know, aviation to a younger generation. I mean, quite frankly, I'm an example of that. As I said from the beginning of the story, it never even dawned on me that there was airplanes and electronics that were even connected together, right? And so, you know, we need to do we the, and I'm talking about the pilot community, not just COPA, but we need to do a better job of introducing people to aviation, and whether it's flying, whether it's maintenance, whether it's, you know, there's so many aspects of it. I mean, aviation is a huge economic driver. You know, it oftentimes gets put on the back burner for bigger things. But honestly, it's just think of how much humanity has benefited from aviation over the short period of time. When you think about when, you know, the Wright brothers essentially, you know, had their initial flight from Kitty Hawk, and you think about where we are today, and you look at aviation, it's amazing. I mean, you can get on a jet and fly, and I could be in London tonight doing business tomorrow. It just didn't,
Amazing.
it's absolutely amazing. But it all starts with that small airport, the little, you know, those Cessna 150s and the training and the desire for somebody to have that spark and that imagination and that passion to say, I want to do that. I want to fly, and it's in a lot of us, for sure. Almost, maybe it's a character flaw for some of us. Like, you know, my wife will often say, you know, how do you know, go to a social event, and how do you know someone's a pilot? They'll tell you in 5 minutes, right? You know.
Absolutely. And, you know, with that that said, I think in the Canadian context, we so rarely see airports being closed.
Yeah.
There's really no playbook on how to do that. And I think a lot of us here in the Greater Toronto area were taken by surprise on May 30, 31st when we got notification that the Buttonville Airport was going to close, and some 200-ish aircraft being displaced. I suppose it's a bit of a challenge with folks that on the GA side that have aviation in their DNA to start a new chapter. Friends, different airport, different environment, different place to have that hangar coffee chit chat.
Yeah, it is absolutely disappointing. I mean, the Buttonville Airport closure at this point was not really going to be a surprise. I mean, they've been talking about it for so many years, and it had been on again, off again. But what's really disappointing, the most disappointing, is that there was no plan. Like, there was no one, there was no from municipal governments, there was no provincial government, certainly no federal government leadership in saying, okay, it's closing, but this is what we're doing next. I think that general aviation and aviation, maybe in general, is neglected by our, you know, elected leaders and officials, because I don't see that they do not see, and maybe this is, you know, partially our fault, that they do not see the economic benefits that come from aviation. And you know, when they stand back and look and say, oh, there's a pilot shortage, you know, when it comes down to that, you can't fly to Cancun for your March break, that's when they turn around and say, well, why? Oh, there's a pilot shortage. Well, what have, like, they look back and don't realize we're all part of the problem. The airports, and the small airports and big airports, but small airports, they're the bridge to economic success for any region. You know, when I used my airplane, you know, one of the reasons and I've had multiple airplanes over the years, but I had an airplane that I used for business. It was my personal airplane. I used it like a car, and I used it for business, but it allowed me to go to places that were really, really more difficult to get to. But I could easily land at a small airport, rent a car, and be visiting a customer. Lots of times my customers were at the airport, so it was even easier. But the ability for me to get more done, it's amazing. Airplanes are time machines. Airplanes allow things, businesses to act faster, to people to get to places they need to go faster. And they really are time machines, and they have a huge benefit economic benefit. You know, think of the number of jobs that just at Buttonville Airport, even the FBO staff, the guy who rented a car there. There was flying schools, there was a maintenance thing, there's all the hangarage that was there, and all those people were spending money. Every single one of those airport, and trust me, as a guy who owns an airplane, you spend a lot of money. Everybody there was spending money. Okay, and that all goes away. And there's no plan for it. That's the disappointing thing. I feel like we've been let down on that side of things. So I don't know how we change it, but we need to change it, right?
Yeah, I think to your point, hit the nail on the head, which is all about the politicians to understand the importance of mission critical infrastructure, like our roughly 1900 plus airports in Canada. At Buttonville during the ice storms in Quebec, our flying club flew medical relief missions out of Toronto into Montreal. And it really seems that the politicians think of aviation in the Canadian context as about, tourism and passenger travel, which is a big part of it. But I think they seem to forget about the bulk of Canadian airports, probably reflected in the composition of the Canadian National Air Transportation Plan, which my understanding doesn't really talk very much about general aviation and protecting it. And
no, everybody's worried about losing your bags at Pearson. That seems to be the focus. Yeah. That seems to be the focus of a lot of what Transport Canada, the Minister of Transport, has been focused on lately, and not focused on all of these other, challenges to not just to general aviation. I mean, obviously that's my primary focus is general aviation, but aviation in general. Aviation is challenged. It's not looked on in the same light that it was 25, 30 years ago. In my opinion, it's taken a backseat, but people forget that, they're worried about delayed flights. Well, everything comes back to crew resources. I mean, Transport Canada has put things in place, that are inhibiting and causing impeding, airlines to operate better, and it impedes us too. And then allowing some of these airport authorities to basically, Transport Canada is the leaseholder on lots of the airport lands. And then allowing some of these airport operators to basically exclude us. They don't say no, but they make it very financially unattractive to go to some airports in Canada. So,
not that we're going to mention them.
No, I'm certainly not.
No,
but they
we
know
wouldn't
who they
want to
are.
Do that.
If they're listening to your podcast, I'm talking directly to you. You know who you are. Yeah.
And that's this whole, one of the outcomes, interestingly, out of the closure of Buttonville is a ripple impact to the cost of hangarage and tie downs at the seven regional airports.
Yeah, it's certainly not a recipe for growing aviation. I mean, there is a lot of challenges, and like I said, it didn't appear to me that there was any plan to how to replace Buttonville. That nobody's really looked at it and said, well, and this again, it wasn't a surprise to the pilot community of Buttonville because it's been going on, but it shouldn't be a surprise to any of the elected officials at all the levels of government, that they haven't said, hey, this is important to us. I want that resource. Buttonville, you're going to lose a resource. I'm going to gain a resource, and putting it in their areas. And, frankly, there is a lot of pressures, financial pressures to it. I have often thought this, and I'm an aviation nut, as it might be, right? Because I've worked the whole time, and I'm, I continue to buy airplanes and do things like that. So I might have some biases here, is what I'm saying.
That's okay. you're talking to a biased audience. It's all good.
I'm sure I am. But the reality I think about it is, like, if I didn't love this so much, why would I continue to do this? I mean, like, it's so. You got to figure that there's so many other things, great things, activities, buy a boat, some jet skis, so many other things that don't have the same challenges to it. I mean, it's not like you can just land your tri-pacer anywhere. It has to go to an airport. Owning an airplane is having access to an airport that's in your community. I mean, you're not going to move the button, you know, from Buttonville to Winnipeg or something like that. It just doesn't make sense, you know? So it's not like you can just do that. So you need an airport that's regionally located. You need to have some space to park it, some place to put it, tie it down, hopefully hangar it if that's in your game plan. You need access to fuel at the airport for it. And you need an airport. And lots of these things are outside of your control. If it go back to my boat example, right? You buy a boat, you put it on a trailer, you park it in your driveway, and on Saturdays and Sundays you take it down and launch it. And it's you know, you need a boat launch, you need water, obviously. If you're in the middle of the prairies, you can't own a boat per se. But, you know, I'm just saying that there's so many other things that it doesn't surprise me that sometimes people throw in the towel. And we don't want them to. We want a vibrant, active aviation community. I mean, I think it really is a beautiful thing. Like I said, it's the last great freedom, honestly, that we have. The fact that I can take myself from this point, move myself through the air, and go to another point and do that, you know, safely and efficiently. It's amazing that humans are able to do this. It's just it's amazing.
And I think it's an interesting comment you made, looking back in the rearview mirror back to the 70s, the federal government had the foresight to set aside 18,000 acres of land.
They're building airports everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. But it seems that the politicians don't seem to have a lot of desire to pull the trigger on Pickering.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't understand all of the dynamics behind that for sure, and I need to get smarter on it, to be honest with you, because I think that is something that needs to be done. It's even more urgent now with Buttonville closing. I think that there needs to be another GA-centric, aviation center. Let me call it that, versus just an airport. But there needs to be that. Let me just wind the tape back there to what you just said, Phil. I think the 70s were important, and we build all that because we were in the midst of a Cold War, and we were coming out of World War II. You know, it had happened a few decades before, but there was still that understanding about how important aviation was, like the air superiority of World War II. That was still fresh in a lot of people's minds, especially the politicians of the day. They would have been younger, obviously, but that would have been fresh in their mind. I don't think the current politicians of the day realize or have that same DNA built into them. And part of that is maybe why we're seeing, they don't see aviation for what it was and for what it is and for what it can be. They're lost in their own dogma of losing luggage at Toronto or missing flights out of Cancun. That's where they see aviation. They don't see it as the great thing that it was.
I think you're absolutely right, and probably a hard point on your comment is the canceling of the Avro Aero project.
Absolutely. Yep.
And with that said, just transitioning the conversation again as a reminder to the Canadian pilot community, we've got this pesky NPA from our friends at Transport Canada focusing on new rules for night flight.
Yes. And that was dropped on my desk day one. Like I started that day, I started and it dropped on my desk. It was the first thing I got to exactly. That was my welcome desk. You know, there was nobody
welcome
brought in donuts. Nobody brought me in donuts. Nobody brought
no coffee
me coffee,
cup.
Nothing like that. Here's an NPA. You need to look at this.
And can you have it done for next week?
Yeah.
Because it's due in June.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I understand it's being pushed.
Yeah.
Out,
well,
which
and
is...
it's, to be honest with you, it's being pushed because we pushed it. Right? COPA took the pointy end of the spear here. And we had meetings with Transport Canada, and we made good, compelling arguments to them that this was going too quickly. And they didn't care that I had just started the job. So that wasn't the argument, but it was the arguments that we wanted something, we needed more time. If they wanted quality, we needed more time, right? So we needed a little bit more quantity if they wanted quality. So they granted our ask. So kudos to them for doing that, because when they started the conversation with us, they said, so we've been asked to extend the deadline, but the answer is no. And now what's your question? but we made a good argument to them, compelling argument, and we've had a lot of feedback. And thank you to the members who are feedbacking, because quite honest, they need to hear your voice. Okay, the voice of the membership and pilots in general. I'm speaking directly because I had sent out some messages directly to our members asking for comments to Transport Canada, but pilots in general should make themselves aware of this. I'm not trying to tell anyone how they should or should not feel about the NPA. But I am saying we need to participate in the CARIC process. And this is the reason. One of the biggest problems with this is there was no, at least in my opinion, no industry consultation on this NPA. This NPA was done pretty much in the dark. And I say that.
Excuse the pun.
It was done in the dark and without real proper industry consultation. So what I think is very important is that Transport Canada hears that pilots, owners, operators want to be heard, and they need to follow their own process. They're not following their own CARIC process, in my opinion. They are doing it outside of what's published policies and processes. Okay, they're supposed to be consulting with industry, the industry that's applicable, the stakeholders, as it were. And you know, COPA is 13,000 members. Okay, we're the largest aviation organization in Canada, certainly the largest general aviation organization in Canada. We should have some input to this. It can't just be happening without any consultation. And so them hearing that and them hearing the comments, the individualized comments too. You know, a lot of people have asked, can you just give us a canned thing? That's actually what's not great about that is Transport Canada looks like at all those canned answers as one answer. And even though they hear it 13,000 times, maybe it's one answer. So they only have to answer it once. I like it when people familiarize themselves with the issues and write what they feel. Good or bad. I mean, if you love the NPA, right. I love the NPA. I can't wait for it to happen. You know, if that's really how you feel about it. But I think everybody should be concerned that the regulator is doing things without following their own processes, by the way, which if we did this, it would be a very bad thing. We'd be in trouble. But they're doing it without following their own processes. And they're making very broad, sweeping changes and not thinking about the unintended consequences. Is everything in that NPA bad? No, it's not. There's some things that are good, and I see the intent of trying to improve VFR night flight. I do. I don't agree with the execution and how they're planning to do it. But certainly, you know, until we have zero accidents, aviation always has risks, and we should be mitigating risks. What I don't like is overregulation. I believe in safety with the minimal amount of regulations as possible and not overregulation, because overregulation ends up having unintended consequences, and you get people doing things that are safe are not legal, and sometimes that are legal are not safe. And I don't like to be in overregulation creates that environment.
And to put things in context, the number of incidents and accidents in Canada is, you know, just slightly north of 100 accidents in the GA side a year, just north of 100. And we contrast that to the automotive sector, where I'm sure there's that number in a day here in the GTA.
There absolutely is. I mean, if you really wanted to go to brass tacks and figure out how to save lives anywhere, you'd shut down fast food restaurants, I'll be honest with you, because there's more people die of heart attacks than it's anything, true. Right? I mean, like, so it's not about that. I mean, when you look at, listen, aviation has risks. There's absolutely inherent risks built into it. We, as pilots, hopefully all understand what they are and mitigate them the best that we can. But they're certainly not without risks. You're waking up this morning and coming into the office, there was risks with that. But they're acceptable risks, so I do it, right? And for me, aviation, there's acceptable risks. I mitigate them as best I can, and I do it. And so we all understand that. I mean, we're all adults in the room. We're all licensed pilots that are doing these activities. And there's currency requirements, there's recency requirements, and we're doing it, okay? And we're doing the best. There's always going to be an accident that happens. That's why they're called accidents. And you can never regulate all of them. You can never regulate them to zero. It doesn't work that way. There has to be a culture of safety. There has to be better pilot decision making, because that's honestly what happens most of the time, is that there are some bad decisions that got made, or maybe not bad decisions, but decisions that could have been made differently that would have maybe changed the outcomes. Maybe that's where the work is. Honestly, the work is trying to better pilot decision making, better understanding of the risks, a better, because once you understand the risks, then you can start planning a mitigation strategy against them. But some of these things, and this concept of changing the ICAO standard, the VMC, IMC definitions to what they're going to call visual flight conditions, VFC. So they're changing the definition that's been an ICAO standard for many, many years. And they're introducing something called cultural lighting, which is the lighting on the ground, and something called celestial lighting, which is the stars and the moon and that. Well, how does a pilot make a decision based on those conditions? There's no forecasting tool. There's no forecast. I can't go on ForeFlight or flightplan.com or even the tran or even Nav Canada's website and find what the cultural lighting forecast is going to be, or what the celestial lighting forecast is going to be. Unfortunately, it's you only know it when you're there and when you see it with your own Mark II eyeballs and say, yeah, wow, it's not as bright as it was supposed to be today, or oh, it's not that, I can't, and but that's some of the things that I don't think have been properly thought out. And part of it, I think, is with this NPA in particular, Transport Canada is trying to answer a TSB finding. Okay. And in doing that, they've painted this with a broad brush, likely because I don't think they're, maybe they're not working as cohesively as a team right now because of, a lot of remote work is going on. So maybe they're not talking as much as they should be internally. I don't know. These are speculations on my part, but certainly there's a lot of, I don't disagree necessarily with trying to get better and safer night VFR. Okay. Full stop. I'll just say that. I disagree with the way that they think they're going to fix it through this NPA, because I don't agree that this has been properly thought out. It certainly hasn't had any industry stakeholder consultation, in my opinion. That's where I think we're flawed. Do I think night VFR could be safer? Absolutely. I agree with that concept, but that starts with pilots and decision making and mitigating risks.
And the NPA talks about night vision imaging systems.
Yeah.
And I'm expecting that that's not something you buy on Amazon for $500.
Oh, it's even worse than that, because not only is it not available, it's pro you probably, even if you legitimately could buy it, you couldn't buy it because they're restricted. Okay. They're restricted for, police and fire and medical and military use. They're kind of a restricted, not prohibited item, but they're definitely a restricted item. There would be an ITAR restricted item for sure. If you were a company making them, you would have all kinds of ITAR restrictions on you about that, which is this, you can't sell things to certain people in the world, because if they're bad people, you're not allowed to sell them. So there's ITAR restrictions. And the other thing is too, you haven't thought about, or nobody's thought about, is that, well, the whole cockpit has to be NVIS capable. So not only if even if you could buy those things on Amazon, you'd be replacing every single instrument and lighting in the aircraft to be NVIS capable. Okay, the airports you go into have to be NVIS capable. All the runway lighting and all that stuff has to be NVIS capable. Otherwise, they just bloom and you can't see anything. All you see is this huge bloom target from the light, right? So they have to change the lighting at runways and airports and that. And then, by the way, you need training. You know, all of this thing about currency and recency and night thing. Now, all of a sudden, you'd have to have NVIS training. And you probably have to do some flights with somebody to show that you actually can operate with an NVIS goggles on and stuff like that. It's a ridiculous concept to even think that GA could even possibly, that this even would be applicable. It's so ridiculous. And this is where I think that, you know, they're trying to answer this. I agree with NVIS for medevac helicopters, for special ops, for police helicopters. These guys are highly specially trained, and those helicopters are all already outfitted for NVIS capable. But and this is where I think things have been painted with a broad brush, and no one's thought about the unintended consequences.
You know, to your point, I contacted a Canadian NVIS manufacturer, mm-hmm. just to talk about an interview and get more details, just to even get more details from them. Talk to the president, won't mention who the company, absolutely did not want to talk to me. Have a nice day, go away.
Yeah, of course. you're a time waster to him. He's like thinking, what is this guy? He's not going to buy NVIS goggles for his airplane. Like,
big challenge. And as you said, we really need to get the membership out in their own words to respond to Transport Canada's.
That's the most powerful thing, honestly. If they had 13,000 comments, they would have to have 13,000 responses. And the reality, I think that they would get an overwhelmingly, wow, we didn't realize that this was such a hot button, and it should be a hot button. But the biggest hot button is, please, let us have it. And that's actually the other part of the equation. So not only did we get an extension to July 6th. So if anybody's wondering what that is, you need to have your comments in by July 6th and copy the COPA, go on and copy COPA's office onto it. We like to also see them just to catalog them, know how much response we've had. It helps us with our conversations with Transport Canada in the future. The reality is that they need to understand that we care and we want to be an industry stakeholder. And so they committed to giving us an extension, but they committed to giving us a seat at the table at the next round. So at least we got ourselves invited to the party, as it were, which we weren't before. They didn't think it was necessary to talk to us for some reason. So, yeah.
Well, that's not cool.
No, and that's the thing. And by the way, I've had conversations with other industry stakeholders that don't necessarily have a night VFR component, because some of them are, you know, gliders and stuff like that. But they should care that this is affecting us today as COPA members, but they could do something in the future that would affect you. And they'll do it in the same way and means, in the fact that there will just be an NPA, it'll hit the streets, you got 30 days to respond to it, have a nice day. And that's not a way, that is not the process. The Carrick process is very clear in how it's supposed to go down. It's very clear. You know, we're not complaining about something that we just made up. We're saying you guys are not following the process. So that is the, in my opinion, that's the number one sin. And the number two, three, four, five sins are all the other things that we've talked about. There's has not been properly thought out and executed, in Mark's opinion. So,
well, Mark, thank you so much for being part of the Plane Talk Cockpit. Any final words for the audience?
Only that, you know, this is a pretty interesting opportunity for me. I really do hope that I'm, you know, going to serve the membership well. I want people to realize that I want to be accessible. So I like doing these types of things, Phil. Certainly anybody can email. I believe it or not, if you email president@copanational.org, I read them. I respond to them. I mean, if you ask me a question, I'll respond to you. If there's something in particular you need to know. But certainly, I think actually, one last thing I will say, that this is also maybe a catalyst to bring industry partners together. We've had conversations with ATAC and NADA and the gliding association and CBAA and all these. So maybe this is a real catalyst for us to come together. So the NPA could actually, the silver lining, as it were, could be that it maybe is an opportunity to unite some of the other industry stakeholders together into a more cohesive voice. So maybe that's a good thing. But certainly COPPA is doing its best to serve its members, to understand what the membership needs are. We're on the forefront of advocacy, the freedom to fly, and basically removing barriers and obstacles from aviation, trying to introduce new people into aviation that maybe don't have those opportunities. Because I really do think that aviation is a rich and vibrant thing, something that has added immense and tremendous value to my life. And I certainly like to share that with others. And those are my closing remarks. Thanks for letting me participate, Phil.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Plane Talk. If you have any ideas for a future Plane Talk episode, please go to the Contact Us page at plaintalk.ca and send in your idea. Don't forget to like us at plaintalk.ca, our Facebook and LinkedIn pages, and this podcast. And never stop living the dream.